Hello and welcome to the Classic Car Weekly podcast. I'm your host, staff writer Jesse Billington, and I'm joined by features editor Chris Hope and managing editor James Sadlier for another quick recap of what's available in this week's issue. Gentlemen, how are we?
Morning. How are you? I'm good, thanks. How are you, Chris?
I'm not bad.
Yeah, I'm doing all right. We're recording this on the Thursday. Usually we try and record these on Tuesdays or Wednesdays, so it goes out with the issue. We're on to a Thursday because I was out yesterday shooting a car for what will go into our restoration show special issue. And yeah, most of the shoot went really well up until a point, but yeah, maybe more details on that a bit further down the line. But yeah, it was the usual interesting array of excitement that comes with doing a shoot very last minute. But yeah.
The
job got done. We've got all the photographs. I've got driving notes. It's fine. We're actually going to talk about a different shoot in a bit, which also didn't go potentially as smoothly as it ought to have done. But first, we'll start as we usually do with our classics. We've all got a lovely little background now with our classics behind us. And conveniently, these are the classics that you'll be able to see at the restoration show on the Classic Car Weekly stand. We're in Hall 5, correct?
Is it?
I believe so, yes.
That's what I've been told.
Not far from the entrance and the stairs. So the entrance to Hall 5, and as you come down the stairs from Hall 4, I believe, you'll find us.
Definitely going to have to get it cleaned then, if it's going to, you know, be right there in full view immediately of anyone who's entering the halls that day. It's not tucked away in a corner somewhere.
in typical resto format. I don't know whether to get like a bale of hay and just kind of put some straw in the
make it
the
barn findy.
And, you know,
that's
what the MG is. Yeah, that's what the MG sort of is going to carry the torch for, is sort of pseudo barn find mid restoration car, because it'll be there without a bonnet and without an engine.
Oh, I don't know, mate. I think your midget's still done more miles than my actually working Mini, so...
just pushed forwards and backwards in the garage a lot at the moment, just to get other things in and out. But yeah, Chris, there you go.
Mine's definitely being still used for... Well, still being used as daily at the moment, but I'm trying to reduce that and look for the next classic, which... I've got a few. I'm not going to show my cards just yet, but I've got a few things that I'm looking at, so I don't know.
Resto show might provide a bit of inspiration further still.
Yeah, well, I kind of know what I'm after. It's just about finding it now.
Are we going to see you in the auction hall?
Well, that could be it, but no, I don't think my funds stretch to the auction hall, but I'll have a little. I'm having a little think. I'm mulling it over.
Okay.
I'm still looking at the MX5 routes, as I'd like something still modern, classic, that I can use a bit more regularly than the Polo. Every time I take the Polo out, I wince whenever I go over any type of kind of pothole in the road. Which I know this is another subject and topic for maybe for another time. But oh my word, to the potholes at the moment. I don't know about where you guys live, but it's. They're okay in a modern car, but in a classic, I wince every time. It really alarms me. I'm constantly in a lane, kind of veering left, like a slalom.
It's not so much potholes that I'm noticing around my neck of the woods. It's just sort of disintegrating road surfaces. They look like roads, but then you drive over them, you feel like you're driving over a gravel track.
Yeah, well, I don't know how other countries with more severe weather conditions can get their roads better, how their roads are better.
I mean, I don't know.
We're going to anger a few people in the government here by saying that, but, you know.
Yeah, we assume someone from the government listens to this. I was heading up the M1 yesterday to go and do the shoot, and in the Jimny, so relatively sort of tall suspension, big squidgy tyres. And you're just being thrown about all over the place. And that's on the M1. And it's just a patchwork of just sort of different bits of broken tarmac. And there are huge divots as you're going down. You're going, that would be lethal on a motorcycle. I don't quite know how they're allowed to get away with that. And they just simply then build another lane next to it and go, it's better. You're like, it's not better. There's just more scope for it to go wrong. But anyway, that's not what we're here to
talk about.
We've
got off topic.
We've got off topic very quickly, which for us is about par. We're going to kick off, Chris, with your behind the scenes from Stuttgart. We sent you overseas to go and find some classic cars.
Yes, I escaped the UK for the first time in about 5 years. Yeah, various things happened. I'm sure you'd be aware of some of them. Some of them you won't be. There was that thing called the pandemic that put a kibosh on things. But yeah, two kids as well. So yeah, it's been a bit of a challenge to sort of, you know, get away. But yeah, no, we've made a really concerted effort as a publication this year to get away to foreign shows. I know that both of you, I know we're going to talk about Stuttgart, but both of you have already this year been to shows abroad. So
yes, yeah, I was in Maastricht in January, and James, you did Retromobile not long before or after. I can't remember the order.
That was the first week of February,
just after. Yeah,
but yeah, so
I think the point I was trying to make is, before I talk about Stuttgart, is that there is lots going on, and it is all within striking distance, with a bit of, you know, logistical planning and things like that. We all flew, didn't we? We all got on planes. You got train.
Yeah, I got the train as well. But what I love about you going to Stuttgart is that the terminal and the show halls are right there. It's brilliant.
Yeah, well, you've been before, haven't you? And I've been before as well, sort of thing. But yeah, it's absolutely amazing. So you fly into Stuttgart Airport. You step out of the airport, and literally you can sort of, you know, look over the building, the road, and you can see the exhibition hall, the Messe Stuttgart right there. Sort of thing. So I think it was all of about a 2 minute walk to get from the airport there, sort of thing. So I think a lot of people sort of mentioned you could do it there and back in the day. I wouldn't want to do that. It feels like there's definitely more than enough there to sort of, you know, spend an evening there, and I don't know, there's enough in Stuttgart as well to entertain people as well. There's obviously the Porsche Museum that I've done before, and there's also a Mercedes-Benz Museum as well. So not to mention all, it's a lovely sort of city, it's a lovely location as a tourist destination, sort of thing. So but the event itself, I mean, just to give you an idea of scale, they had 77,000 visitors and exhibited 2,200 cars. So last year's Classic Motor Show at the NEC had 71,000 visitors and 3,000 cars. So it was busy, but I think would you say it's bigger than the NEC in terms of square footage? I didn't take the time to look. Certainly, it's what I like about the Messe Stuttgart is you have like this central sort of atrium spine, and then you have all of the show's hall sort of branching off of it, sort of thing.
It's like a tree.
And you can, yeah, you can move between the halls as well, sort of thing.
It's quite quick and easy. Yeah.
And the other thing that it has is that the main hall, the larger hall one, it has like an upper galleria. So you can sort of look down on all of the content inside, and even some of the smaller halls, because it's sort of built on the side of a hill. You have like these areas of sort of balcony where you can look over, sort of thing. And when you're moving from one hall to the next, you go up a set of stairs and you can again look out and look over, sort of thing. So I found it just really easy to navigate in that regard. And the content that they have is very nicely segregated. It's very clear that there's a massive manufacturer presence at this show. There's not a BMW hall, but the BMW manufacturer stand is very much front and center. I think it was hall 5, doesn't really matter, sort of thing. And then everything else was offshoot of that, sort of thing. So it's kind of themed. And you can get a sense of where you need to go, sort of thing. I mean, there was an entire hall dedicated to coaches, which isn't unusual. And I know that it's been like that in previous years, hasn't it, James, sort of thing. But there was just so much random stuff that I wouldn't see at the Classic Motor Show. I'm not even talking about cars here, obviously. A heavy accent on sort of German manufacturers, Opel in particular. You get like the Cadets and things like that that you just very rarely see in British shows. Now they had German army helicopters. They had a barber cutting people's hair there. They had a tattoo artist putting tattoos on people. It's all just a bit random, but it somehow kind of works. And it's
that's
nice changed
a bit
as well.
Yeah.
They've got sort of these massive sort of windows at the end of the hall to let in loads of natural light, sort of thing. So the cars are brilliant, but they look fantastic in the light as well, sort of thing. So
last time I was there, they had a bit outside as well, not a huge amount. Based maybe a few cars for sale.
Yeah, all been scaled back because I couldn't get to the gist of it because my German is appalling despite doing it at GCSEs. But there is some sort of construction project. I think it might be a new sort of train station terminal that they're building outside of the exhibition hall. So there was a few cars there. They weren't all cars for sale. All of that cars for sale stuff is now in the hall itself. That upper galleria that I mentioned was exclusively for private cars for sale. So you could sort of walk around and chat to the owner. The owners were all sort of sat there with their sort of camping chairs. They were there for the weekend to field inquiries sort of thing. But the other new thing was that the actual that atrium spine that I talked about, it had brand new Aston Martins in, which is great if that's of something of interest sort of thing. But the really good thing was that they had a mix of both privately owned and dealer cars for sale that were all exclusively under €10,000. So you had things like there was a Ford Sierra that sort of jumped out in sort of left-hand drive, like a really early sort of Sierra. But there was all sorts of other things as well. There was Mark II Golfs. There was some Fiat 500s, things like that. It was a real sort of nice mix. I don't know how you would go about sort of, you know, organizing to go there and buy a car on a whim and then come and get it. So I think, I suppose you can make a deposit and then make a separate trip to go and get it. But it's entirely possible, I would imagine, with enough planning one that you could sort of buy a car at the event and then drive it home sort of thing.
Drive it back. Yeah,
get a one-way flight and then make your own way home in your new classic sort of thing. So
that's quite a nice idea, isn't it? A one-way flight there and come over. So given it's a German show, obviously, there's going to be a lot of, you know, German marks there, but BMW, Mercedes, etc., etc.
Yes.
So there was a good mix of different, you know.
Yeah, I mean, brands. The Germans are massively into their American metal, so there was a huge. Right. So I think it was Hall 3. Half of Hall 3 was literally American cars. You know, various sort of Dodge Challengers and Chargers and things like that. But there was what they call British Corner as well. So they amalgamate all of the German car clubs that cater to British marques in a single area. So you have like the Triumph Club of Deutschland, you have the Mini Club and things like that. So the Mini Club in particular is quite interesting. There was a Mini that was a limo, so it'd been extended by using three different Minis. It's actually, if people can cast their mind back, you can have a look on YouTube. It appeared at the Mini anniversary, and I think it was 2009 at the Goodwood Revival, where they had the big fleet procession. They had Rowan Atkinson on his Mr. Bean car sat on top.
I remember.
The brush directing the traffic sort of thing. But apparently that limo was there because it had like the crest for the Goodwood sort of venue on its just above sort of the windscreen. And yeah, it looked fantastic. It looked absolutely brilliant. So I could never sort of pin the owner down to find out how it found its way to Germany, or if it was in fact a German car to begin with that then came over to the Revival, especially for that event sort of thing. But I'd be curious to know sort of thing. So
I could see myself doing that with the Polo, you know, kind of stretch two or three more Polos, and that would make a great limo.
It was like the Top Gear sort of Chris Moyles limo. It was it gave those vibes. It was quite impressive. So
what was the Chris Hope car of the show, if you were to take one home? What would you have?
Oh, well,
I know it's hard to choose, but
it may not have been quite my car of the show. But the one I wanted to talk about was this special edition Porsche 911. Okay. So it's called the Pepita, which I found out is in English, it's houndstooth material. So apparently it's 60 years this year of Porsche using Pepita on their 911s. So there was a dealer called Early 911s, and they supplied a car to an initiative called RareSphere, which if I've got time I want to talk about as well. But the gist of it is that they also enlisted the help of Stephen Merkert, who is the longest serving designer at Porsche, to come up with some ideas in terms of how you could run this, create this Pepita special edition car. So they had things like normally in he sort of joked about it, that it's a very German thing to only put that Pepita cloth material on the front seats, because nobody uses the rear seats. So the rear seats are just sort of your normal sort of, I think it's vinyl sort of thing. So he extended it into the rear seats. He extended it on the knee bar, which had quite a nice effect as well. There was a decal that on the bonnet. Normally sort of they do sort of like when they do decals on the 911 S's, it was the side sort of sills and doors sort of area that gets used. So it's quite unusual to put something on the in the center of the bonnet, but it's like it starts at the top as the completed houndstooth material, but then it runs out and sort of separates, so you can see the individual elements that go into it, which again, quite nice sort of thing. So it looked amazing, really, really brilliant sort of thing. And to know that, you know, a genuine sort of Porsche designer was involved in sort of bringing that together with his years of experience was quite something sort of thing. But Rare Sphere itself is quite an odd sounding sort of initiative, but it's headed up by I'm going to get this wrong, but it's Chiara Acle. And she had some really quite interesting ideas. They've only started this Rare Sphere up in the past couple of months, so they debuted at Retro Classics. We've spoken before on the podcast about how the show organizers who innovate are going to be sort of the real winners, those who show flexibility and perhaps cater for a younger audience. Chiara very much sort of saw the same things at the events she's been going to in Germany, but came at it a slightly different direction. What she has come up with is a sort of a concept where she brings together cars that are exclusively of interest to a younger audience to create a show within a show for anyone who wants a show within a show sort of thing. So the idea that it is quite challenging for organizers who are sort of set in their ways, as she put it, to learn how to use Instagram, to engage with people on those platforms. She can do all that for you. And she can then bring that younger audience into your show. So it's a really interesting concept. I mean, the connection she must have must be incredible, because she was able to get a 911 Carrera RSR Turbo 2.1 from Porsche Museum. She was able to get Singer to get involved and have one of their cars on the stand as well, sort of thing. So, yeah, you definitely want to talk to this lady about having your sort of cars at your event. I mean, I sort of asked her if she had any interest, if this does well in Germany, would you be interested sort of, you know, maybe approaching like Goodwood or approaching Silverstone or things like that? She's like, yeah, that would very much be the ambition, to take that sort of concept global sort of thing. So, Rare Sphere on Instagram, by all means, go and have a look. They're showing various some of the cars that they had at Retro Classic, so you can get a better sense of it. But I just thought it was a really interesting concept, and I didn't know whether it was something that maybe someone here in the UK could maybe pick up and sort of run with as well. Take the idea of having someone who is immersed in the both the very German sort of way, was sort of like bringing the digital and the real worlds together. And I sort of see where they're getting coming from, but it is that quite, it's sort of like something lost in translation sort of idea. I don't know. It screams like maybe Caffeine and Machine could do like a pop-up at one of the sort of the more traditional sort of cars in a field type event, just to instantly bring the people, the average age of those people attending down. It feels like that's something that could be sort of done in the UK as well. And I found it really interesting. So I've talked a lot. I'll stop talking now.
No, I like the idea.
I was very excited about Stuttgart. It was brilliant. It's the first time I've left the UK in 5 years.
I mean, ignoring the sort of travel issues that you had that sort of made it a little less of an enjoyable experience. But
yeah, 4-hour delay coming back to Heathrow. It is what it is.
Yeah, but no, I like the idea of sort of a pop-up sort of element to more traditional car shows that sort of brings in a younger audience, has something to it. We've said on the podcast multiple times before that to sort of keep these shows going and alive, they need to innovate and have a unique selling point. We said it about Race Retro. It works because it's got the live rally stages, the go-kart demonstrations. The Resto show works because you've got all that live action of cars being worked on while you're there. And for sort of other shows to achieve that, they need to have that USP, that little additional thing. And yeah, like you said, opening up to younger audiences with a sort of selling point for that younger audience would be a prime way of doing it, really. Yeah, it sounds like a very wholesome time. And I'd love to see some more pictures of that that sort of houndstooth Porsche. I think that'd be great to sort of get some more pictures of that shared out on the socials. So if you've got shots of it, send them over.
Get
them splashed around and get them into the video for this as well. Because I love the idea of sort of essentially the fabric sort of disintegrating down into like its original sort of bare threads. It sounds like sort of, sort of from its pre-woven stage to into the sort of iconic material, you know, for Porsche interiors. Yeah, so it's an all-round solid collection and a great trip, it sounds like, and hopefully one that will encourage listeners to head along to the next Stuttgart. Do we know when that is yet?
Yes, they have announced the dates. Obviously, Retro Classics is an organisation that runs other events, and it's worth going on their website and having a look. I'm not going to try and sort of second guess what it is, but I do have the dates for next year's show because they have announced them. Give me a second. Sorry, I should have had this ready. February 19th and February 20th to February 22nd next year.
Excellent. So get booking, I suppose, if you fancy heading along. It sounds like they're going from strength to strength and really sort of bringing along some new and innovative ideas. Though up to you whether or not you get a tattoo while you're at the show. Meanwhile, elsewhere in this week's issue, of course, we've got Car SOS is back. We've got a lovely behind-the-scenes peek into that. There's a chance to pick up a Bangers and Cash TV star, and the London Ambulance Service is turning 110 years old this year. It's actually got two anniversaries. 110 years since we started using motorised ambulances, and 60 years since the London Ambulance Service essentially became the service we know today. It sort of unified all of the services that have been operating in the Greater London area to create the London Ambulance Service. And to find out more, I went along. They've got a historic collection they keep in a sort of a big workshop down in Kent. And I said, can I have a go in one? And they said, yes. So set off with Snapper Ian Skelton and went down for a day out in just near Sevenoaks. Brilliant, brilliant day out. If the London Ambulance Service ever got their historic fleet out at shows, go and have a chat with them, go and have a look, because the history that's associated with these things is fascinating. I think I sort of overwrote massively when it came to sort of reporting on this and writing it up, because the social history tied in with an ambulance and the way that they have been sort of, they were never their own service until quite late on. They were always just something run by either the police or the fire department or like the local council, and then eventually someone said we should probably make this actually a part of the health service. And
I love that idea that in the earliest days it was just simply sort of stretchers that were strategically positioned at sides of roads, sort of thing. So
yeah, it was literally just sort of, I think the one they've got in their sort of fleet is what's called the Bischofen handcart, and it's literally just essentially a wheelbarrow you can put a person in and pull a small hood over their head, and that's it. And I think the original history of them was they were used for simply transporting the unwell and the drunks. And the earliest form of London Ambulance Service, I think, was run by more of an asylum system than it was actually hospitals. It's all that sort of very strange formative thing in the early 1900s as we form the idea of a public health service. So it was, yeah, sort of going from that to horse-drawn carriages. Early ambulances were also technically boats that ran up and down the River Thames through the city. And then eventually we figured out there's probably a fast way of doing this. We'll use vehicles and sort of internal combustion engine to move them about. So it was an interesting sort of thing watching the growth and progression of the vehicles as they moved. And
were they kitted out much in the back? You know,
early ones weren't. They were very basic. The idea was basically it was patient transport. That if you've been in a modern ambulance, it is patient treatment. A modern ambulance runs north of, I think, £200,000 by the time it's been fully kitted out and ready to go. It is an expensive piece of kit, and it is full of a lot of important sort of medical kit. Early ambulances, you got a canvas bed on a metal frame and that was it. Even into sort of the 1960s, you weren't really being treated by the ambulance that arrived. The ambulance that arrived was simply there to take you to hospital. You were maybe stabilized, a bandage was slapped on, you were maybe given gas and air, and that was it. You were just chucked in the back of a Morris and driven to the nearest hospital.
Was it just the driver, or was it a team?
It's a team. It's a crew. They always refer to it as a crew because you have it, and they never refer to it as just the driver because essentially they're all medically trained as well. Just they also happen to drive the ambulance. So you'd have essentially a driver and a secondary crewman that would be also sort of operating as a paramedic in that instance. And yeah, it was great learning about all this detail from the sort of very well read up team of volunteers that runs the service. There is one person that's full time, Craig, who sort of oversees the collection. The rest of it is done by volunteers who give their time. It's part of the charity sort of arm of the London Ambulance Service. So all the work they do restoring, preserving these bits of important history is done sort of out of the goodwill of donations, which is very important to note. And they've got north of 15, I think, vehicles shoved in there as a lockup, from everything from early Talbots and Daimlers all the way through to sort of stuff that would have been around on the road in the 90s, the noughties. One of their most recent vehicles was one that was sort of donated by BMW. It had been a paramedic car at the 2012 Olympics. It never seen use on sort of public roads, registered for road use and everything, but it had just sort of been, most of its mileage had been accrued just driving around the inside of the Olympic Stadium.
Right. I think I remember that from the opening ceremony when they brought like the London taxi out. Is that what they're referring to?
No, this was just, it wasn't for display. It was just there in case there was a medical emergency during a sports event during the Olympics. The paramedics were sort of in a vehicle. Obviously, BMW, I think, was the motor sponsor for the event. So they were in a BMW, I think it was an X5. And it was just sort of, that was the latest addition to the fleet because it's got this interesting bit of history. It was sort of one of the roles that the London Ambulance Service has had more recently, but everything from sort of LDVs, Bedford CF2s, Morris's, all the way back to the really early stuff and some more interesting stuff like response command vehicles. So essentially, if you've got a big emergency that's happening, you don't just send a load of ambulances and just hope they figure out what they're doing. You have a sort of command center that can be placed there that will operate to control which ambulance is dealing with what, which paramedics are going from where, who's going to which hospital with which person, and you can sort of essentially set up your own triaging unit on location. And again, the sort of the way that as vehicles evolved and provided more useful roles, the ambulance service went, yes, we can use one of those for doing this, we can use something like this for doing this, right from sort of bicycles that are used for sort of visiting different smaller bits of London to the Renault Espace paramedic car, which has a giant radio antenna that extends out the top of it. So if they're operating in a busy zone, they can essentially set up their own radio communications network. Should something go completely wrong, they're still online, they're still able to communicate. So it's
even though they had to be quite rapid back in the day, how were they to drive and handle? Did you put them through the test? Did you put the siren on?
I did get to ring the Winkworth bell on the Morris. So the interesting thing with, obviously everyone knows sort of, you think back to your old sort of Wolseley police cars, Winkworth bell on the front, ting-a-ling, you sort of get out of the way for the policeman. The ambulances had the same sort of bell system. And then by the late 60s, early 70s, they were starting to adopt the more sort of familiar Blues and Twos siren system. But if you're in City of London, so the very core bit of the middle of London, it has its own rules about it. And you couldn't use a siren until much later in the 70s. So even into the 70s, ambulances still had to have the bell. So again, one of those weird things. It was great fun driving the Morris. It was like driving a van, but a period van, I think, is the best way of describing it. Very manual, but an automatic gearbox, which was, let's be kind and say, proving to be a bit recalcitrant on the day we were driving it. But it was an experience, very heavy going, very noisy, and it wasn't fast by any means. If you think the modern van can keep up with road traffic relatively well, I think the Morris, even in period, would have been outclassed by the most humble of saloon cars. So keeping momentum would have been sort of key to fast response times, and gaining momentum takes a lot of effort in that car as well. It's got a 2.2 petrol inline four, mated to an automatic gearbox, and you just sort of keep your foot down, and eventually it starts to build up speed, and then you've just got to try and sort of twirl the wheel in a way that doesn't topple the entire thing over. They did lower the bodies on the ambulances just to keep them a bit more stable, so they're a lot more sort of better handling than the typical Morris van would have been at the time, but it's still not great. So it was certainly a learning experience to try and drive one, especially when it decided to be a bit senior in the middle of Sevenoaks at rush hour and would refuse to engage drive, pulling out of most junctions or away from most traffic lights. The solution we found was just sort of run away. Basically, by this point we were being followed by the team from the London Ambulance Service's historic fleet. They were in the BMW, so they were also trained and authorized to use blue lights because most of them have been ambulance drivers. They were able to just stick on the lights on the BMW and sort of half escort us back out of Sevenoaks and away from trouble, which was quite a fun experience.
We need them for some of our future photo shoots, don't we?
I would say for every shoot I've been on recently, there's been some sort of mechanical mishap. It'd be great to just have the ability to just switch on some blue lights and be escorted away from causing chaos in a major urban environment. It was quite fun for Ian Skelton, the photographer, with us, and I, and obviously they have all the old uniforms, all the badges, all the paperwork, all the medical kits that would have been used from the dawn of the service through to present day. And included in the van that we had borrowed for the day was a period uniform. I didn't try the uniform on, but I did put the hat on, and it was quite fun. Because I'm an idiot, and as soon as you give me a hat to wear, I'm going to put it on. So it was an exciting day out, and a great insight into something that's so easily overlooked. I mean, I've been in an ambulance before, carted off to hospital after cutting my foot open on a beach as a child, and it sort of still sits like a high watermark for like sort of boyhood adventure or sort of escapade gone wrong. You sort of, you always want to be a policeman, you always want to be a fireman, you always want to drive an ambulance. And I think sort of slowly I'm ticking off those things that 8-year-old me has always wanted to do. So I've got to somehow get hold of like an old police SD1, I think would be quite fun, and maybe an old Dennis Bowery. Ice cream van, or maybe steam train. I think steam train would really heal some boyhood issues. But
Have you done fire engine? I haven't yet, but I was reliably
informed by the London Ambulance Service that the London Fire Brigade does have a historic fleet, again, somewhere around the South London area, that they do keep a variety of vehicles in. And
maybe we could just pick one each and be like, you know, kind of the classic emergency services, you know.
You're an
ambulance driver. Chris and I'll just pick a straw for the fire brigade and police. I'm happy. I haven't put many fires out lately, but I'm sure
I like the sound of that police SD1, particularly if it's a VA.
Yeah.
So.
Yes. Getting back to
ambulances though, Jesse, does the obviously it's a big sort of anniversary for the ambulance service. Does that heritage fleet that you worked with have any intentions to exhibit at any shows or anything? Do they mention anything along those lines? Or any chance for listeners to get to see them themselves?
They haven't got anything set in stone, but obviously while it is these huge milestones, there will be events coming up. So I'd say sort of keep an eye out on their website. If I think they've got a couple of social media platforms that they update. So keep an eye out on what's happening. They will be at some of the larger events that are coming up. That again, they haven't fully nailed down what they're going to be doing, but there will certainly be things that cover the history. I think we were sort of the first to jump on the bandwagon because I know the press department from the General London Ambulance Service went, oh, no one's thought about doing this yet, so thank you. And sort of we've sort of first out of the blocks with this, so it's we're waiting to see what they do to actually celebrate. They said this, what we've sort of put together, would be quite an interesting
way to
see how it goes.
And if we hear anything, we'll try and find space for it in the paper as well.
Oh, we'll try and mention it, yeah, because it's the array of stuff there is fantastic, and again the knowledge of the team that we met on the day was sublime, and the stories they've got are, as you'd expect, incredible, from sort of so many years of accumulated service, from sort of the starting in the sort of 80s and 90s right the way through to sort of modern ambulance driving. But interestingly, the fleet is still used when you're doing your blue light training, and when you're training as an ambulance driver, part of your course is you go down and see the historic fleet and you drive the older stuff. And they say it just sort of helps keep the history alive, helps keep people aware of sort of the job they're going into and sort of what it used to be like. And a lot of sort of new ambulance drivers will have had the chance to have also gone and driven the old LDVs, a Bedford CF2, the Morris like we had. And then they'll get back into their modern Mercedes Renault Peugeot and go, actually, this isn't half bad. I've got sort of aircon that works. I can hear myself when I'm driving along. And it's a bit faster than most modern traffic will go. So it's interesting how the historic fleet still sort of plays a very important role. And it's given all new meaning to sort of when you see those blue lights come up behind you, you're sort of a bit more aware of what they're up to in the cab. Possibly not quite as noisy as the Morris these days, and not quite as strenuous on the shoulders, that did not have power steering and had very tall, very heavy tyres. So it was a proper sort of policeman shuffle to try and slow manoeuvre that. And even once you're on the road, it doesn't really get much lighter. I think I came away from the day absolutely aching. So newfound respect certainly for that. But Metropolitan Police and your historic fleets, get in touch. I'd love to come and hoon about in a police SD1 and perhaps wear a policeman's hat.
Oh, can I go for the kind of Ford Sapphire Cosworth then?
Oh, motorway police response car, yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's the one, motorway response car, yeah. It'd certainly be a little bit faster than my little Polo.
Yeah, that'd be a good one to get Anstead involved in as well, because of course he used to do a bit of police motoring work. So certainly if we can find a way of tying that in, I think he'd be more than happy to flick on the blues and twos and write some words for us. I don't know if any of you read his book, Cops and Robbers, as well.
Mm-hmm.
very, very insightful look into the world of sort of historic emergency vehicles. So there's more to it than thought, much like when we sort of do a few auction pieces on historic or classic commercial vehicles. There is this surprising community that we so rarely get the chance to even scratch the surface on. So it was, yeah, well worth persuading persuading the editorial team that I should be allowed to go and pretend to be an ambulance driver for the day. But yes, there's also a supplementary video on our YouTube channel as well, which gives you a bit more of a behind-the-scenes peek into sort of what went on, how we put the feature together, and
how loud it was,
and also a brief interview with Craig Kenty from the Historics Fleet, who sort of gives some slightly more formal detail to it, and so he's sort of the brains behind the operation, keeping it all running, and credit to him and the team, because it is the collection they've got is incredible. They've got somewhere in the region, I think it was 3,000 bits in their archive from the ambulance services history, beyond just the vehicles, all the sort of tools and medical equipment they all have used. So it's If you're interested in that sort of social history, it is fascinating. But yes, that's I think we've chatted on for plenty today.
Interesting things. I have a quick question actually
regarding ambulances. If you are a kind of like a fan of these vehicles, have either of you seen any kind of classic ambulances for sale or similar?
Not because there are
people like that. You do go to car shows and you do see the odd classic police car. I'm sure if you've been, and even the odd classic fire engine that someone's bought. But obviously, police cars probably a bit more easier to find and obtain. But what about ambulances? Is there much of a market for those?
There isn't a huge market for them. When they get demobbed, they often do get sold on. I know that certainly when it comes to more the modern fleet that's being sold on, Brightwells have a huge trading hand in certainly old police cars going through it, and often the old ambulances or paramedic cars. The other thing is they often do lead hard lives. They're usually an ambulance is always driven at about sort of 9/10 on the public highway. And as a result, while they are serviced and maintained properly, at the end of the day, you're buying an old diesel van that's been sort of run relatively hard. So often they are sometimes sold on, they're rare to come to market. When it comes to classic ambulances, they are out there and they do trade hands every now and then. But again, the amount of them that survived, the survivorship bias just means that they are quite rare things. The NEC last November, we did bump into a lass who owned a Vauxhall. Oh, this is going to test my memory. Was it a Magnum estate that had been a private ambulance for the... I think it would have been Slough Hospital. And again, that was just something that she had known had been, it was like a sort of one of three conversion that had been done in period as a private ambulance. And that would have been sort of, she knew about it because she'd worked for Slough Hospital at the time. So knew about the vehicles that had been produced. And thus sort of when they were sort of shipped out of service and just sort of been left in a lockup, when they re-emerged, she knew about them and was able to sort of get hold of one and get it back. So they are sort of rare things to find, and sort of, again, this sort of rarefied piece of history and an important one. Odd one, have either of you ever been in an ambulance?
No.
When I have been, I was unconscious, so no. I've been in one, but I don't have recollection, sadly. Although, one of my favourite experiences with ambulances is when... Because often if they're on the motorway, they don't often go above 70 mile an hour anyway. Mm. But when you pull out behind one and it's cutting through the traffic and you could just cruise nicely a safe distance and speed and legal speed, of course. And you get to go, but it's similar to that scene in Die Hard 3, with Vengeance.
Yes, using an ambulance as a blocker through New York traffic.
And it cuts through the traffic. So, yeah, many thanks to that ambulance that day. I mean, to be fair, it lasted about all of 5 minutes. But plus, my cars don't go that far over 60 miles an hour anyway. So even on a motorway, you're pretty much in the slower lane.
But if you, the listener or reader, have got any fun recollections of sort of period ambulances either used to drive them or you've been in the back of one, let us know in the comments section. It'd be interesting to sort of hear your thoughts. Treat it as like the letters page in the printed paper. Let us know your thoughts or your stories. It'd be interesting to read and hear about them. Certainly if you were an ambulance driver, you might have had a better experience than I did trying to get through Sevenoaks at rush hour in a 67 Morris. But there we go. We've got plenty more to crack on with. We're building up to our issue before the restoration show, so this will have a preview of the resto show in it, where of course we've already mentioned our three cars are going to be on display on the Classic Car Weekly stand, with much more to enjoy at the show besides. What else we've got coming up in this issue? I've lost track of where we've got to with it.
That's a good question, actually. Let's have a little look. Chris, over to you.
Yeah, who hasn't got his feature planner up?
Car SOS is, we have another edition of Car SOS going in. Yes. On page 8. Our lead feature that we've got we drive a BMW 3 Series E90, and yep. Also, I'm just cruising through.
Got buying guide for the Ford Capri Mark 3, and
yes.
Where are we off to on the way we were? That was it, so. Trussville, 1955, and a brilliant Andrew Roberts one as well. They're always a great read.
We also have our very first monthly view on auctions, where we look at the month in auctions of February, looking at some of the data, and that's the first of our series now.
We've got that new series started. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
To be able to compare all the auction prices from the whole month as one big list rather than in, you know, kind of different auctions.
Mr. Sinister has been busy with the spreadsheets.
He has,
yeah. He loves a good spreadsheet.
That's why he's gone on holiday now. He just needs a break from it. It's broken him.
He needs to prepare him for the March auction results, which he'll need another holiday after that.
He spent 72 hours in one hit compiling a giant spreadsheet and has then since gone on holiday, which is fair enough. Anyway, that's all we've really got time for on this week's issue. Thank you very much for listening. And of course, remember to pick up the paper that this all relates to and give the stories we've mentioned a read. And we will see you for next week's, possibly a podcast next week, though we will be setting up at the NEC. So maybe it'll be a video instead, giving you some behind the scenes on what to look forward to at the restoration show at the NEC. So, gentlemen, thank you very much for your time this morning.
Awesome. Thank you, guys. It's been a pleasure.
And Rita, we will hopefully see you in some form next week.